Our Bible reading this evening is taken from the first chapter of the Bible. So at the very start of the Bible, first book is Genesis, and in chapter 1, we're going to read from verse 26. Genesis chapter 1, and we're going to read from verse 26 and read into chapter 2. We've had a number of weeks that we've not been going through our study in Genesis and the beginnings, chapters 1 to 4. In fact, I don't even think we've met this year to think about the beginnings and what these chapters say to us. So this evening we're resuming our thinking about the beginnings. We're going to be thinking about the beginning of rest. And so we're going to read from verse 26 into chapter 2. Then God said, "Let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals, and over all the creatures that move along the ground." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, and over every living creature that moves on the ground." Then God said, "I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth, and every tree with fruit, tree that has fruit with seed in it, they will be yours for food. And to all the beasts of the earth and all the birds in the sky and all the creatures that move along the ground, everything that has a breath of life in it, I have given every green plant for food." And it was so. God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. Thus the heavens and the earth were completed in all their vast array. By the seventh day, God had finished the work he had been doing. So on the seventh day, he rested from all his work. Then God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it he rested from all the work of creating that he had done. Let's leave our reading there for the moment. We'll return to it in a few minutes' time, and we do pray God will help us understand it this evening. Let me encourage you to open your Bibles to the words that we read, the first chapter of Genesis. And we're going to be thinking, in fact, it's actually the second chapter of Genesis. We're going to be thinking of the words in the opening verses of chapter 2. We've read from chapter 1 and into chapter 2 to get our context. And we're going to be thinking this evening about these words in the opening three verses. "Thus the heavens and the earth were completed in all their vast array. And by the seventh day, God had finished the work he'd been doing. So on the seventh day, he rested from all his work. Then God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it he rested from all the work of creating that he had done." Well, after a long day, or perhaps a long working week, we have this urge to rest, don't we? We have this urge, we have this need. It can be a physical thing, it can be a mental thing, it can be both. But we reach a level of exhaustion where we know we must stop and somehow begin to recharge and begin to recover the energy that we have expended. And so we need to rest. We've got a finite amount of energy, and if we go through that finite amount of energy, we don't have anything left over, and we need to rest and recharge, don't we? And reading a passage like this, you would think, well, maybe is that what's happening to God? Having been so busy, as we have studied in chapter 1, having been so busy putting into place everything that we see, that now, somehow, God was slightly weary, or God's energy was drained. Perhaps God needed a breather. We might think it's a simplistic way of kind of viewing things. That's what happened with this special seventh day. God rested because he needed to. And yet, with one of the great principles that comes to us from the Reformation, that event that we remembered the 500th anniversary of last year, is that the Bible interprets the Bible. And a simplistic thinking of God somehow being like us and needing rest would be wrong. The Bible tells us about God that he's the everlasting God. He's the creator of the ends of the earth. That he does not grow tired or weary. And his understanding, no one can fathom. Because where we have a limited supply of energy and knowledge and power and all these different things, God is unlimited. And God is infinite. And so were we to conclude that God needed a breather, but so by the time he came to day seven, we would be absolutely incorrect. That is not why day seven is different to every other day that's given to us in this section of the Bible telling us about how things came into being. God made this day different for a reason. He set it apart. He made it separate. He made it holy. And the reason that he did that is the theme of our message this evening, the theme of our study this evening. As we think of installment number four in our series of the beginnings, we've thought about the beginning of everything apart from God. And we've thought about the beginning of life. And then we've thought about the beginning of humanity. And this evening, our next installment is that we are thinking of the beginning of rest. And so as we do so, we're going to be confronted with truths about God that I pray are going to impact the way we think and are going to impact the way in which we act and live as God's people. I want us to notice this evening two things, two key truths from these opening three verses of chapter 2. Truth number one is that God completes. Very simply, God completes. That's what verse 1 says. The heavens and the earth were completed in all their vast array. I'm sure if we went round this evening with one of these roaming mics and you were willing to speak and to tell us about the favourite aspect of creation, there'd be a whole host of different answers that would be given. Some people would speak about the sunset, or others may speak about the sunrise. Others might think about the intricacies of a snowflake when you see it under magnification, or the purity of a drop of rain, or the stunning color of a rose, or the power of the wind, or whatever it might be, that there would be hundreds of possible different answers as to what is it in the created natural world that we just find so stunning. And there's so much of it, isn't it? It takes our breath away. Even the other day, traveling back from an event, and you saw the Firth just like a sheet of glass. It was just so still and so beautiful. We've been thinking up until now in our studies of how every single element of the stunning reality of the world that God has made is explained to us in chapter 1. It's explained to us as to how it came about. Because we only have two explanations. Either God has put this in place, or some other power or force or whatever has put this in place. And it takes more faith to believe that than it does to believe in a God who has power and authority and a plan and has put it into action. Chapter 1 has introduced us to a God who is a personal God. He's a God who speaks. He is a God who blesses. He is a God who makes assessments. He is a God who creates. And from verse 1 of chapter 1 all the way through, we have seen how God has gone from things, from the nothingness that was there, and with increasing complexity, called into existence the variety of different acts of creation until he reached the pinnacle. And we saw when we examined humanity that humanity is the pinnacle of God's creation. So God has authored, he has originated, he has planned, and he has implemented everything that we see in the world around us in that sense, except himself, because of course he existed all the time. And so all this was done in the words of the Bible. By the end of the sixth day, that's all there. So verse 1, chapter 7, what's going to happen now? Because although the individuals who put the chapter headings in the various different parts of the Bible, because the chapter headings are not in the original language, although they thought, well, that's the end of it, they should have kind of twigged that it's actually not, because of the repetition of different things within chapter 1 that come in multiples of 7. So, for instance, in verse 1, there are 7 Hebrew words that tell about God's creative work. It tells us that there are 14 times in chapter 1 when God speaks, that there are 35 mentions, 7 times 5, 35 mentions of the name of God. We have other issues there as well that tell us that there's various other different excursions into the 7 times table. And so all this has happened in day 1 to 6, all the remarkable work of God's creation. Well, what's going to happen in day 7? And so there should be a sense, or there would have been a sense for those who are reading this in its original language, well, what's going to happen in day 7? Because if day 1 to 6 has been so significant, what is going to be the significance of day 7? And the significance of this first Sabbath day, this first seventh day that God rested, is exactly that. That God rested. We may have thought there may have been other work that still needed to get done, but there wasn't. We may have thought that there may be other tasks that needed to be attended to, but in that sense, there wasn't, because God specifically makes a point of resting. Now, what does that say to us tonight? Well, it tells us a couple of things. The first is this. You may listen on various different documentary channels to scientists who will argue and disagree over whether or not the universe is expanding. And various different highly qualified individuals will put forward their rationale for why the universe is expanding, and others will put forward their arguments of why the universe is not expanding. And they will have their various different arguments back and forth, and sometimes you're left wondering what on earth either side are actually saying. But nonetheless, scientists disagree on whether or not the world is expanding. Verse 1 tells us here that while our understanding of the universe that God has created is expanding, it is not that God is adding new parts to it. That it tells us here in verse 1 that what God started, he has finished. And it's not that God started and finished and then said, I'll put a wee extension on here. I'll build a little kind of universal kind of granny flat onto the thing to make it a little bit bigger than I anticipated originally. No. What God starts, he finishes. And our limited understanding of the universe, and isn't it remarkable how we're gaining more understanding of the universe, and science in that sense is just so wonderful that we can understand more than previous generations could. But our expanding knowledge of the universe does not necessarily assume that the universe is expanding. Perhaps God made it in such a way that it is. We don't quite know about that. But what we do know is that God finished the work of creation. End of. And so however scientists will argue one way or t'other, and however we will come as individuals with finite knowledge trying to understand the God who is infinite, his word tells us that the heavens and the earth were completed. We're finished. There is no further work of physical creation that needs to be done. Now, we noted before that God does still bring light out of darkness, but he does so in a spiritual sense in the life of individuals who have lived their lives up until that point, rebelling and rejecting and ignoring God and the world he's created, and then God works by his power and they come to life. That's different. That's not the work of physically creating this world. The world has been made. And the Bible tells us it's been completed. So that's the first outworking of the statement about the heavens and the earth being completed. The second outworking for that is quite interesting for us as well, because it reminds us that God does not leave things undone. There were different economies 10 years ago that suffered through the economic crisis. Some suffered more than others. Some nations suffered. We think of places like Greece, and they're still suffering. One of the places that really did suffer was the Republic of Ireland. I remember a number of years ago traveling from the north down to the south of Ireland to get a ferry across to see family in Wales. One of the striking elements of that road trip, driving through the Republic of Ireland, was the amount of construction sites that had been abandoned at various stages of development. You had some sites with literally mansions being built on them, And you could see, even with a token understanding of the construction, you see that they're not far off being finished, but they're abandoned, and it was evident that they've been abandoned now for years. You go along a few miles down the road and you'll see another development, maybe not quite as advanced as the first one, but it's all abandoned, it's all derelict. And site after site after site after site. In the end, I stopped counting. And it's then you begin to realize, well, actually some of what politicians do and, you know, the control over banks, and that's actually really quite important, because there's a lot of work there that was started and was left in various different phases of being incomplete. Now, that can never be said about God, because when God starts something, he finishes it. When God starts the work of creation, he finishes the work of creation. When God starts the work of salvation, he finishes the work of salvation. Because God is not somebody who gets distracted and moves on to another project. Some of us may have different DIY projects at home and various stages have been incomplete, but the latest thing has happened and we need to do X, Y, and Z. God's not like that. God finishes what he starts. And that's got a huge pastoral impact upon us. A huge pastoral impact. Think of it this way. You may tonight be one of God's people, and you feel like you are almost drowning with the temptations that you are facing. It seems just almost constant. And you're left questioning, you're left wondering, am I actually going to be able to survive this? I've been tempted before, it's been pretty bad, but I've never had temptations like this. This is horrendous. Am I going to cope? And then you think through the issue kind of biblically, and we realize the God who we're dealing with is a God that tells us in Philippians chapter 1, verse 6, and when God starts a work, that God will bring that work to completion. Again, what God starts, he finishes, and that is a token of encouragement to us. Or perhaps we're thinking about individuals who maybe worshipped with us, maybe in this building, in years gone by, in months gone by. And you've not seen them for the past number of months. You've not seen them for the past number of years. And they used to be so fervent. They used to be so involved. You could see the passion that they had for the Lord, but something's changed. And their seat is empty almost. You know, and it's hard when you see friends who are no longer here. It's even harder when you think of family members. And you're wondering, well, what's going on there? And then again, you think through biblically what we're told about God from these words and from other parts of Scripture. Well, when God starts something, God finishes it. And when God begins a work in somebody's life, he will bring that work to completion. And oftentimes, some of those whom we have almost written off because they've been backslidden so long, they seem to have been away so far from God. Isn't it remarkable when he brings them back? I remember a discussion that we had with the elders in the previous congregation I served, and we were trying to go through the different joy that we would experience in hearing somebody being saved, which is just remarkable. But also the joy about hearing someone who has backslidden for all these years being brought back by God. It's remarkable. Because what God starts, he finishes. He's not going to abandon. He's not going to leave halfway through. How is that the case? Given the fact we are weak, well, if you're anything like me, and fragile and subject to all manner of temptations from the world, from the flesh, from the devil, how can we speak about God in this way? Well, we speak about God in this way because there is no power and there is no influence superior to God that can ever possibly usurp his power, that can ever possibly hinder his promises, that can ever possibly dilute his plans. It's impossible because God is God. Think of our Savior. Think of all the plans and the promises that converged on our Savior at when he came into this world at his birth, at the incarnation. All the plans and promises that converged then, and the other plans and promises that converged through his ministry, and the plans and promises and prophecy that converged through his death and through his resurrection. And we think about God's plans being worked out. We think of the way in which Jesus on the cross at Calvary uttered the words, "It is finished." And he comes out with that single term in the original language saying, that's it. The last installment has been paid. The debt is now clear. The debt of sin has been dealt with once and for all. So on that basis, on the basis of his finished work, we have that assurance that what God has started, he's going to complete. We have the assurance of the finished work of Jesus to deal with our past, present, and future sins. Jesus is never going to go back to the cross to do some mopping up operations of the sins that have been committed since he was last there. You and I are not going to go onto the cross to deal with that because it's been dealt with. Because when Jesus was there, the payment was given, the last payment. The ransom was handed over. The curse was accepted. The wrath was faced. The penalty was paid. It's finished. And it's on the basis of his finished work that we have confidence that God is going to finish his work in us. What God starts, whether it's in the work of creation, whether it's in the work of salvation, God finishes. And we can have assurance in that. And it's not that we should perhaps have the mentality that prevailed in the Highlands over many years is, oh, well, you know, can't be too sure about these things. And, you know, there's a degree of kind of skepticism. And is it unspiritual to have that assurance in that kind of sense? Well, it's not unspiritual. It's not unbiblical. It's applying biblical truth to reality. What God starts, he finishes. And he is the one that we look to in that sense. And so the final, I suppose, pastoral impact of this would be for any of you in here tonight who do recognize that you're being drawn to God. You recognize that there's an attraction to God that you can't explain. You didn't have it before. You've got it now. Perhaps you've seen it in some other family member or friend. Perhaps you've just come to appreciate the dissatisfaction of the turmoil of this life. And there's something in the Word of God that resonates with you. But as you think about it, you think, well, I'll just make a mess of it. I won't be able to live the life that I should live. If I start this Christian life, what if I muck up? Is that not going to be even worse for the cause of Jesus than if I didn't start it in the first place? And we can be filled with a whole host of different reasons that all originate from the same source, from God's enemy ultimately, as to why we couldn't do it. When you don't have to look at why you couldn't do it, or why I couldn't do it. Because it's God that's the focus. If it's God that's starting this work in our lives, it's God who's going to finish this work in our lives. And yes, if you look at yourself, and if I look at myself, and others looking here at themselves, they'll see every opportunity of failure, or every opportunity to fail, and to cause all manner of distress. It's not about us in that sense. If you are being drawn by the power of God to himself, to a living relationship with him, don't be put off with any of all these crazy thoughts that the enemy might sow the seed there. If you're focused on God, remember, God completes. What he starts, he finishes. The second truth from this passage is given to us in verse 2 and 3, where verse 1 tells us about God completes, verse 2 and 3 tells us God rests. God rests. Well, history books will tell us that at different stages in this world, various different charismatic leaders have decided that the seven-day pattern that we live by was something that could be altered. Back in the French Revolution, days of the 18th century, I think it was, then they ditched the seven-day pattern for a 10-day pattern instead. It didn't last long. They found out that it was not simply detrimental to their physical, but mental and social well-being. It just didn't work. Fast forward a couple of centuries later, and Stalin in Russia, he decided, let's ditch the weekends. Let's just have 5 days in the week. And that's what he did. Weekends were binned. And again, socially, psychologically, mentally, physically, people couldn't cope. Why? What is it about this seven-day pattern that seems to work? Well, the answer is given to us in the fact that this is a pattern that our Maker has actually set for us. This is a pattern that he has given to us. He's decided that this pattern of 7 days is one that incorporates time to be active and time to be passive. It incorporates a proper proportion and a balance to our existence. And when we deviate from it, it doesn't tend to work out very well. We live in an era where academics write lots of different reports and conduct various analyses on different subjects. There have been multiple reports written by highly qualified individuals about the negative effects of shift work up to 10, 14 days, and other less specific times that have altered from the 7-day pattern. Those of you who live and have to operate under shift work, you know the difficulties that it can be to somehow get into a kind of normal routine. So what is it with this 7 days? This is something that God has put into place. It tells us here that God rested from all his work. And you're saying, well, what does that actually mean? He rested from all the work of creating that he has been done. In other words, God has rested, but God is not inactive. In the sense that God has rested from any further physical creation work that he had been engaged in. But were God to be inactive and not involved in any other level, then this world would have descended into absolute chaos. Because while God rested and ceased from the work of creation, God continued his work of providential rule, governing, sustaining this universe. If even for a matter of seconds, God ceased to sustain and to govern the universe with his providential rule, then everything would be utterly and truly chaotic. So when we think of God resting, he is resting from a specific activity of his work of creation. When Jesus tells us in the New Testament, in John chapter 5, that the Father has been working until now, and Jesus also is working, it's in the context of his providential, sustaining, governing rule that's happening here. So God is still active in providence in that sense. He has ceased from the work of creating that he has been doing. And so this pattern then that God chose to implement, wasn't forced to. Getting back to what I said at the start, wasn't fatigue that kicked in, but God deliberately chose this pattern to give us a pattern and to give us a proportion as to how we would live our lives today. And so when many people are negative, even in the church today, about the Sabbath principle, the 1 in 7 set aside for rest in that sense. Many of these critics will go back and say, well, listen, actually, I go by 9 commandments. I don't go by the 10th commandment. 10th commandment for me is now obsolete, and they'll give various different reasons that in many cases don't stack up. But for me, they say the 10 commandments, I have 9. And the obvious answer to that is that, well, actually, you need to go right back to creation for where this principle comes in. Because what the 10 commandments do is effectively codify something that was put in place there by God in the first place. And so however people may just want to try and fixate on the 10 commandments or the 9 commandments, the biblical answer is actually you go back further. Because this is something that our Maker at the very beginning decided this is what the created world should live by. For the people of Israel, when they were given the 10 commandments, it was not a negative thing for them. You know, often people will talk today about the history that they've had perhaps in this country or other places with Sabbath observance, and it was very negative and it was very dark. For the people, the children of Israel, having come out of hundreds of years of slavery, when there was no such thing as an EU working time directive, where there was no union to plead their cause about the amount of hours that they were having to put in. There was no one they could really complain to about any of these issues. But for generation after generation after generation, were slaves working day after day. The thought of one day in seven, how remarkable. What a blessing. God has given us this one day in seven to think about his work of creation. But more than that, as it's told us in Deuteronomy chapter 5, to also think about the work of God's salvation for them. So for those slaves who were being released from the awful existence that they were in, they were now given this blessing, this day to think about God's wonderful creation, to meditate on God's remarkable intervention of his saving work, and to appreciate their God. And yet, in our generation, we class this as something that's perhaps negotiable. Something that perhaps, it applied at a time. Does it really apply for us now? This is our Maker's instructions. We are a society that is as stressed as any society in history. We are living under pressure. We have this people have this constant access to us. We have this thirst for knowledge at our fingertips with our mobile phones. What is one of the great draws in the psyche with regard to a mobile phone today? It's having knowledge at your fingertips. Where does that thirst for knowledge on our terms stem from? It goes way back to the start of the Bible. Goes back to Genesis chapter 3. We are a generation that needs rest. And yet we're a generation that has turned our back on rest. And the church has even been complicit in this. And so we're missing out. We're missing out on an opportunity to rest in the reality of who God is and what he's done in his work of creation and in his work of salvation. To bring this to a close tonight, let's just go one step further, thinking about rest. What is rest? For you, is it just lying on a beach somewhere with a couple of nice novels? Is that rest? Is that your picturesque image of rest tonight? What is a definition, a biblical definition of rest? Well, one definition that I came across recently is that rest is knowing safety in a place where you are known and loved. And so resting in the Lord is a place of safety where he knows us and where he loves us. So resting place is knowing safety in a place where we are known and where we are loved. A good number of centuries ago now, a man called St. Augustine came up with a very famous statement, probably the most famous statement that's ever quoted from Augustine, when it talks about that our hearts are restless till they find our rest in God, effectively. And what Augustine was pinpointing at that point in that culture was that however busy people were, that until they recognized that there was a dimension to their existence that was spiritual and needed to be satisfied, they would forever be restless. And the rest, therefore, the true rest, is not downing tools physically. It's not somehow letting our minds be emptied through listening to whale music or something like that. True rest is actually about being in a relationship with God. It's very interesting that when Augustine lived, it was a time of real social change. We're talking hundreds of years ago. And yet back then, we're talking about individuals whose hearts are restless. Now we might turn around and say, well, okay, Mr. Augustine, if you think your life is kind of quite stressful and life and society are restless in your day, you should time travel up to 21st century Scotland. Then you will know about restlessness, and then you will know about the chaos and the turmoil that's living in most of our lives. If you think you needed rest in your day, how much more today? I'm pretty sure Augustine would have answered along the lines that our need for rest is not dependent on how fast or slow paced our lives actually are. We make a mistake when we simplistically put it in that kind of terms. Fast paced, high pressured life, you need rest. Actually, we all need rest. We all need a place of safety where we are known and where we are loved for who we are. Where we no longer need to put on a front, that we don't need to pretend we're something we're not, because the people in that place of safety, they see right through. They know what we're really like. And it's not that we're finding this place of safety even in family, as much as we dearly love our families, because our families do not know 100% of what we are like. If our families did know what went on in our heads, if our families observed us in the way that God observes us, can you imagine the carnage that would follow? But we need a place of safety where we are known, warts and all, and yet we are loved. A love that will never end. Do you know where that's found tonight? That's found in the God who creates and completes. The God who rests and sets a pattern for us. The God who speaks, the God who creates, the God who assesses, the God who blesses, the God who invites, and the God who in his Son, that greatest of revelations that we have of God, says, "Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest." You see, true rest, it's not physical. That's not me saying that we should not look after our bodies. Trust me, we should. We should look after our bodies as best as we can. But true rest is not physical. True rest is spiritual. Let me ask you tonight, do you have a place of safety where you are known for who you are? Hypocrisies, inconsistencies, sins, questionable motives, where you are known and yet you're loved. That is available to you in Jesus Christ. And he invites you to come to him, weary and burdened as you are, and you will find rest in him now and always.